Joan Walsh is our guest this hour. Her new book has a title that will attract attention, and it's a good title, I think. What's the Matter with White People? Why we long for a golden age that never was. Joan is joining us by phone from Tampa, where she's been covering the Republican National Convention, and we'll start our conversation with that convention. She's editor-at-large of Salon. She is an MSNBC political analyst. She is a woman who has strong Wisconsin ties. She went to Shorewood for high school. She's a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she is Black Irish, and we will find out during the course of this hour what that means. She writes about it in a very interesting fashion in her new book. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Joan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can leave messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We have so much to talk about that even an hour seems short. But you are in Tampa, and you did write today about Paul Ryan's speech last night. We're in Wisconsin. You know Wisconsin. So
yes,
let's talk about what you describe as an anti-Obama feisty speech that will have fact checkers working for days. You think he was loose with the facts?
I think he was a little bit loose with the facts, and I think he was roundly called out for it last night, although today the coverage is settling down into, well, he wowed the crowd, and I guess that's all that matters. But, you know, straight from the top, Kathleen, he had that awful lie about the president raiding Medicare to the tune of $716 billion. When the Paul Ryan budget takes the exact same savings from Medicare, President Obama applies it back to health care, whereas Paul Ryan applies it to more tax cuts for rich people. But the notion that you can stand up there in 2012 and accuse the president of something that you also would do and that you also apparently believe is good policy, because it's we don't have the time to get into exactly what those cuts represent, but it's basically cutting fees that are overpriced for certain kinds of services, to demagogue the president on that when you do it too and think you can get away with it. It was really kind of breathtaking.
Well, you must think that you can get away with it. For what reason?
Well, the journalists will clutch their pearls for the night, or, you know, for the first night, and then go on and really just look at the bigger picture of, well, what is this doing for Mitt Romney? And, you know, also I think we live with this false notion that both sides do it. And, of course, both sides do exaggerate, and both sides do score sometimes cheap political points. But there's a difference between exaggeration and flat-out lying. And you know, Paul Ryan had a lot of fibs like that in his speech. He accused the president of basically standing by while the Janesville GM plant closed, when, in fact, the decision to close it was made under George W. Bush. He attacked him for not following the recommendations of the Simpson-Bowles Commission on deficit cutting when Paul Ryan was on that commission and voted against its recommendation. I don't know. That's three. I think I had five, but we don't want to take all hour. It was rather stunning.
Yeah. Let's talk about the whiteness of the party. I really like the title of your book, and there's so much to discuss here. I can't remember who said this at this point, but somebody talked about the Republican National Convention being so patriotic because either the floor is red and the chairs are blue and the people are white, and you have said that the Republicans have doubled down on whiteness. 9 out of our 10 self-identified Republicans are white in a country that's 60 to 62% white. You say it's a demographic and a political and social disaster.
I think it is. You know, I'm very clear that I'm a Democrat, but I grew up with Republican. I have Republican friends now, and I have Republican family, as I write about in the book. So I really don't mean to demonize Republicans or say that all of them are bad, and certainly not all of them are white. But when 9 out of 10 are white, it's really a problem, because racial change gets politicized and politics gets racialized. And in a country that's really always been proud of its capacity to pull together and the notion of e pluribus unum, out of many one, to have that stark a divide in our in one of two political parties. It's not like we're a multi-party system where, you know, you might have some fringe party that's mainly ethnic or religious like you have in other countries. This is, you know, we only have two parties. One of them is going to govern a good portion of the time, and in some states, in lots of states, they are the governing party. This is really a disaster. I think it really makes it harder for us to solve our political problems, and it makes it harder for us to face our multiracial future.
Mm-hmm. One of the people who spoke last night was Condoleezza Rice, and many of the commentators, as you well know, really praised her speech, saying that she was just wonderful. She could be the face. She could be president in a minute should she decide to run. Would it behoove the Republicans to really carve out some kind of place for a woman like Condoleezza Rice that's very much front and center? Would it change the party?
I think it would change the party somewhat, but the real, you know, the reason that she was never on anybody's short list for vice president was that she's pro-choice. And so, you know, the other part of this is the social and cultural issues that they've allowed to dominate the party. They're dominated by one race, and they're also dominated by a very, very marginal fringe point of view on issues like abortion and gay marriage. I don't know her stance on gay marriage off the top of my head, but I assume she's socially tolerant. So, you know, she was widely applauded. I mean, she really was the best. She's the best speaker that they've had so far, by far, both in terms of the content, the delivery, as well as people's reaction to her. But there's never any serious talk of making a place prominent place for her in this party as it is, because she can't get past that first gate of being pro-choice.
On to the book. What's the matter with white people? You spend a lot of time referring to your father, referring to your Irish roots in the book, and some fascinating chapters in Irish history and Irish American history and slaves and Irish. You talk about it, your father's telling you the tale of your being Black Irish, which will take us into a lot of stories. What does that mean?
Well, no one is sure what it really means, but to my father adopted one definition, and it's out there. It's not crazy. He didn't make it up, but it's probably not true. He told me that the Black Irish people who have dark hair and darker eyes or hazel eyes, as we do, as opposed to the redheads and blondes in our family, that we were the product of mixing between the Spaniards who came over on the Armada and Moors who came over, and that there was prejudice against the Black Irish in Ireland, and that we should, he told me this against the backdrop of the civil rights movement. It was, I think he probably told it to me in, you know, 1963 or so. The best I can date it is, I think it was before I went to kindergarten, when we used to spend a lot of time by ourselves talking. And it really made an impression on me. I think he was trying to say, it's really a kind of do unto others story, as in, you know, prejudice is wrong for moral reasons, but it's also stupid because you really don't know your own background, and you could be prejudiced against somebody who's part of you. And it really, I think it was a very formative story. It's not that I thought I was Black or part Black, but that just the possibility made me realize that we're all linked in some way, and that particularly the civil rights movement of that moment was the most important social and political and moral movement of my lifetime, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. And that whole story of the Irish going to places where they were indentured servants that had large Black populations, islands of the Caribbean, is still being researched pretty heavily, right? You may know a lot more about that during the course of your lifetime.
We may. I mean, it's actually something I know, I really knew nothing about. For all of his talk about the Black Irish, my father didn't mention the fact that there were literal Black Irish, as you say, in the Caribbean islands. And in the 80s, I was checking into a hotel for
Oh, I love work. That story. Yes.
Oh my God.
I know.
I'm checked in by a woman named Joan Walsh, and she happens to be Black. And we start talking, and she's from Jamaica. And she tells me that I should come and I should, you know, meet our family. And I really wish to this day that I'd taken her card and taken her up on it. But, you know, the Irish were, Cromwell was known for, you know, banishing the Irish to hell or Connaught, the west of Ireland. But he also banished many of the Irish who fought against him, the Irish Catholics, I should say, because that's an important distinction, to the colonies and to the West Indies, and they were called slaves in many accounts. Now, this is another one of those really sad stories where you can't really, where it's hard to talk about it, because I also learned, you know, there were people called slaves, and whether they were actual slaves or they were indentured servants, and we can talk in a minute about what the differences were, there were thousands of them, and they were in horrible conditions. Many of them died in that condition. But the first thing you learn as you start, you know, to go on the web, Kathleen, in your spare time,
right?
Start Googling
okay.
this,
okay.
And you find these sort of Celtic pride, white supremacist sites that vastly exaggerate the numbers, vastly exaggerate the time span, but also use it to say, hey, the Irish were slaves too, and they got over it, you know? So it's like, oh my God, this story that I feel like should lead to some kind of solidarity, of
right.
course, leads to white supremacy.
Right.
Oh, how does that happen? But on the other hand, you know, I think that there are African-American scholars who've written about this, and then there are some who are not comfortable with this notion, because there is, we have to be careful that there does become a very, very profound and horrible distinction between indentured servants and slaves. But in the 17th century, for most of the 17th century, black people were also indentured servants. It wasn't until there were lots of servant rebellions, actually, between Irish and black indentured servants and English indentured servants, that the powers that be got very frightened that they were outnumbered by this multiracial servant class that was unruly and getting violent, and that's when they imposed slave codes and they made African American slaves for life and reminded the Irish and the English that they were only servants for 7 years. They enforced laws against intermarriage, and they made mixing criminal, basically. And they elevated white people above, the white servants above the black slaves, and, you know, we're living with that legacy to this day.
We sure are. You can tell that you've kissed the Blarney Stone from the Gift of Gab. Let's talk about a time when there may have been some solidarity. I was not aware of this history or this connection between Frederick Douglass and O'Connell, and I did not know that there was a statue to Frederick Douglass in Cork, Ireland. Tell me that story, and was that a time of solidarity in some way?
In some ways, it very much was. I mean, I was researching the book, and I had MSNBC on in the background when President Obama went to Moneygall, Ireland. It turns out President Obama is also black Irish. On his mom's side, he has Irish roots in Moneygall, this little town of Moneygall. And he took the time, he was, you know, greeted joyfully in Ireland, and he took the time to go back to this little-known episode in history in the 1840s when Frederick Douglass, the great former slave abolitionist, became close to Daniel O'Connell, the great liberator of Ireland, fighting for Irish freedom and independence. And O'Connell, in addition to fighting for Irish freedom, was a staunch abolitionist and really worked with Douglass on the issue. A lot of abolitionists in this country, including Douglass, black and white abolitionists, really hoped that O'Connell's great popularity with Irish Catholics in the United States would make them come onto the side of abolitionism. And so they banded together and they wrote an address that he signed to the Irish in America, telling them to join the abolitionists. And President Obama talked a little bit about this friendship and about this episode, but he didn't talk about the sad way that it unraveled.
And what is that sad way?
Well, when O'Connell made this appeal, he found that a lot of Irish Catholics were hostile to the abolitionists, not only for racial reasons, maybe not mainly for racial reasons, we could debate that all day, but because a lot of abolitionists were nativists of the time, were staunchly anti-Irish Catholic, and really came out of a Protestant evangelical movement that had a lot to recommend it on the question of slavery, but really believed the Catholics could not be full partners in the American experiment, that we were slaves to the Pope, as well as that we didn't really work hard, we drank too much, we partied, a lot of stereotypes that would later be applied to other people. And so a lot of Irish Catholics in the United States were very resistant to that call and said to O'Connell, we can't do this because these are the people that, you know, are coming after us. There were, I mean, nativism was not a state of mind. It was a movement. I mean, it turned into the Know-Nothing political party.
Yes.
But it was also, a very violent movement where Catholic churches and convents and schools and homes and businesses were burned and attacked in riots throughout the Northeast in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. So this was a very vulnerable time for Irish Catholics, and so they were not... They really didn't receive that appeal very well.
It's a fascinating story. Let's talk about the Irish Catholics and the Democratic Party. And I love the story being told through the eyes of your father, because he was obviously a very influential person in your life, in the conversations that you had about race and civil rights, etc. How did he, and was he emblematic of other Irish or other ethnic groups, embrace the civil rights movement? It was a huge thing for him and for your family until your mom split and went a different direction, which I want to talk about. Why did he take on that cause? And I think we need to talk a little bit about that cause, which was so huge in the last century.
I've thought a lot, there are psychological reasons that I think he embraced that cause. The simple moral reason, people ask me about his politics, and I say, he was just a really good Catholic, and he thought, he thought that this was the right and moral thing to do. I think he also may have identified to some extent with black people. I think he was sent away as a child. His family was very poor during the Depression, and the three oldest brothers were sent away to religious orders to get education. But I, in an earlier phase in my life when I was a little bit less understanding, I dismissed it as foster care for the Irish poor, which really made a lot of people in my family quite upset. But the fact was, they were a very poor family for a while. They climbed out of poverty. And my father joined the Christian Brothers at age 13. So did his younger brother, my Uncle Connie. And they went to a Christian Brothers boarding school and then to college and became Christian Brothers themselves. They obviously left later to get married. And, I think that something in that exile experience, being exiled from his family, made him identify with people who were outcasts. And I think that he also felt, a profound opening up of society in the beginning of the 60s, as did my mother. I mean, I think they both felt that, society was making good on some of its promises and that we were moving in the right direction. I think I write in the book, though, that, I mean, they loved John F. Kennedy, but they also loved Pope John XXIII. I mean, the Vatican II was as influential in their politics, I think, as anything else. They really felt that the church was opening up and that the moral imperative was on the side of opening up to other people and helping others who were different, and they really resonated with that. And so for the early part of the 60s, I think they were both very, very thrilled and devoted to that.
Can you now tell the story of your mother being a convert to the law and order policies of Richard Nixon? And we'll move more into a discussion of race here, how Richard Nixon may have courted people like your mom and used, not that your mom went to law and order, but the issue of race to get people to go to the Republican Party as a result of all that was going on during those years.
Yeah, and I take pains in the book to show how it wasn't all about race, and I would especially want to say for my mom, I don't believe it was about race at all. She remained a strong civil rights liberal, but I think that liberals sometimes forget the extent to which the 60s and early 70s were a really scary time. We are rightly proud of the social movements that made change, like the civil rights movement, like the feminist movement, like the anti-war movement. I believe that we were on the right side. All those movements were right in their aims, but there was a kind of crazy, violent fringe to all of them. And it was just a fringe. But, you know, where I think that Dr. King really had a genius for appealing to white Americans' sense of wanting the country to be a better place and appealing to our sense of we want to live up to the ideals of our country. It's not that our country is bad or the ideals are bad, as people would say later, but that we just haven't always done our best, and we can do better. You know, the early civil rights movement, I wrote a couple days ago on the anniversary of the March on Washington. That was it was mainly black, overwhelmingly black, but it did have some multiracial support, and it was overwhelmingly a movement for jobs and justice, and it talked in its flyers about white unemployment. And so, you know, those early movements were stirring, they were multiracial, they were nonviolent, and as change didn't happen fast enough, there developed a violent fringe to the anti-war movement, of course, particularly. And, you know, in those same years, crime rates did go up. Divorce rates went up. There was a sense that, you know, life for children and families wasn't as good. There was arson in the cities. And so for my mom particularly, one of her twin brother was a firefighter and her older brother was a cop, both of them in New York City. Mm. And she was terribly afraid for their safety. I think she just saw society coming unraveled in a way that scared her, you know, and a lot of it, I love the series Mad Men, and I thought that this past season it was unbelievable because I write in my book about the Richard Speck and the Charles Whitman killings. Now, those guys were, in 1966, they were white. I mean, a lot of, right. You know, Charlie Manson, right. The Manson family, they were all white. There were a lot of white people wrapped up in the craziness. So it certainly wasn't mainly racial, but there was just this sense that things were out of control. And I think that my mother, you know, I write in the book, we never knew for sure whether she voted for Richard Nixon, but she would, the fact that she wouldn't tell us and she told us it was a secret ballot made me and my father pretty suspicious that she had gone in that direction out of her fear of chaos. Hmm.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Joan as well. Joan Walsh is our guest this hour. She is the author of a highly interesting book that looks at her experience as a black Irish. It looks at the sweeping events that took place during the middle part of the last century, particularly, although she goes to previous centuries as well, to look at why we long for a golden age that never was. What's the matter with white people is the name of this. So she takes on all kinds of issues, including, and we can talk about more of these, the racism that may be exhibited toward the current president, why it is that nobody seems to be addressing, as we've talked about the last few days, the issues that are of concern to a lot of minorities who tend to be poorer than others, and why it is that nobody's looking at specific needs of African Americans, particularly for this president and the Republican Party, which tends to be not as inclusive as the Democratic Party, and why these issues are still with us in so many ways. She is, you know, is a commentator for MSNBC, so she's been outspoken on many of these issues. She's editor-at-large of Salon.com and author of What's the Matter with White People. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joan Walsh, our guest, What's the Matter with White People is the name of the book. 800-486-8655 is the number, and our lines are rapidly filled. We start with Benjamin in Mequon. Hi, Benjamin.
Hello, ma'am. My comment is that I'm happy to see that Western culture has evolved past the judgment of hating people or denouncing people just because they have a different race or ethnicity. And it's kind of sad to see the Republicans throwing back to disliking the president, which kind of seems like it's racially based. From what I've heard, I wasn't around during the Clinton era, but it didn't seem like they hated him that much. You know, it kind of the intensity has gone up, it seems, because of his race.
I agree that the intensity has gone up because of his race, although I would point out that, you know, President Clinton was vilified by the Republican Party. He was called a murderer. Jerry Falwell said the most horrible things about him. The vast right-wing conspiracy, as Hillary put it, really worked overtime to depict him as literally a drug runner. They accused him and Hillary of killing their friend Vincent Foster, who tragically committed suicide. And then they impeached him over his sexual indiscretions, which were regrettable, but if people with sexual indiscretions could not serve in Washington, the city would be empty. And so there was a pretty fierce attack on Bill Clinton. But you're right, with Barack Obama, the racial component is impossible to miss. And it's really tragic that a lot of the leadership of the Republican Party, I say all the time on MSNBC, that the last moment of honor in the Republican Party was in October of 2008, when John McCain was confronted by a supporter who was railing against Obama and calling him an Arab, and McCain very famously stops and says, "No, ma'am, he's a good man, he's a Christian, I just happen to disagree with him." And, you know, not that there's anything wrong with him being Muslim, but that at that moment, that was a profound thing for John McCain to do, and we really haven't had a moment like that since. We had Mitt Romney just last week descend into the sewer of birtherism by making a, quote, joke in Michigan that no one's ever asked me to see my birth certificate. They play with this racial fear of the president as other. They play with it for political gain, and it's really, really sad to see.
And we've wasted so much time on it. Come on, there's so many other things to talk about. All the time we've spent, and you've had to spend, talking about the birth certificate.
Oh, my God.
Ah, what a waste. What a waste.
Really,
you know,
really.
Read about Frederick Douglass instead. You know, do something else. What about this? I know you're at the Republican convention, and this has been an issue that's been discussed in the past few weeks, this inability for Romney to close the deal with working class whites. I'm wondering if there has been a campaign strategy to inject some of these themes like birtherism. Can you point to a policy to do that in order to appeal to working class whites? And haven't we gone beyond the point where some of those racially based themes wouldn't work with working class whites because they've moved beyond that, or not?
Well, you would hope so, but I'm not sure. I mean, ever since Richard Nixon and Pat Buchanan really turned welfare into a code word for, you know, black poverty and black laziness, sadly, we've seen that these coded appeals around welfare often work. And the New York Times had a very well-reported piece with Republican strategists and Romney strategists talking without their names attached, so there were no named official sources, but there were quite a few sources saying that because they had not closed the deal with white voters and working class voters, they were doubling down on what they called cultural appeals. And you know, one of them is welfare. I mean, over and over they are using this ad which claims that President Obama did away with the work requirement for the welfare program that was imposed by President Clinton. This is not true. Every fact checker in America, and some Republicans too, I should add, have said that is absolutely not true. The work requirement stands, but they have several versions of this ad now. And you know, you go back to Ronald Reagan talking about strapping young bucks buying T-bone steaks with food stamps and Cadillac driving welfare queens. Mm-hmm. These are old tropes, and they sadly still seem to work somewhat. There's an amazing Medicare ad, you know, back to the Paul Ryan lie about Obama taking this money from Medicare, and it features this worried white senior, and there's wording on the picture, and it says, "You paid," and the message is, you white seniors paid for your Medicare, and now they're taking it away from you, and they're giving it to those people who get Obamacare. Now, Medicare is 77% white, while the people who will get insurance under Obamacare, it's more like half white. So, you know, those statistics are not in the ad. I'm adding them, but that's the kind of racial fear and identification that they're working on. And, you know, the real problem for Romney is that the white working class base of his party doesn't like him and they don't trust him. And as Mike Huckabee famously said, he doesn't look like the guy they work with. He looks like the guy that came in and fired them. So he's having to resort to these racial themes. Mm.
Thanks very much for the call, Benjamin. Let's go to Dave in Fish Creek. Hi, Dave.
Well, good morning. I'd like to just take issue with the very premise of this, seemingly, and I was wondering if this was just a catchy title for a book or if your guest really believes that the problem is with white people. I think it could be more broadly addressed to people in general. But I guess my question, I'm going to change it a little bit. Where are the coded messages from the left or from the Democrats? I mean, you make this broad attack, accusation, that everything that comes out of the mouth of white politicians is somehow a coded message. Where are the coded messages that you see from the president and other Democrats or liberals, left-wingers, whatever you want to call them? And I'll gladly take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
All right, Dave, thanks for the call.
I'm happy to give you the answer on the air. I mean, I think that I'm glad you raised that question because I think there is a double meaning to my title. And honestly, since we have a lot of time on this show and I appreciate it, we can get to the second meaning. I'm not slamming white people. I love white people. I am a white person. And also, when I say what's the matter with white people, one of the meanings is I feel that the multiracial left, and including, excuse me, many people in the Democratic Party at times, can act like white people are not part of their multiracial coalition. And so, you know, if you can say the title with a little bit of maybe a New Jersey accent, what's the matter with white people? Why aren't they good enough for your, you know, Democratic Party coalition? And so I would ask the caller to read the book because I go into great detail about my own struggles as a Democrat with people feeling there's no group that you're able to stigmatize more comfortably on the left than the white working class. It's fine to call them ignorant, racist, what have you. And I was a Hillary Clinton supporter during the Democratic primary, and I got into a lot of arguments about this with people of all colors. I would say the white left, honestly, is the worst, claiming that, you know, a vote for Hillary was a vote for whiteness and that white working class men were only supporting her because they refused to support a black man. Excuse me. And I took issue with that, as I think the caller is taking issue with what he thinks is my premise, because, you know, I found Hillary Clinton to be somewhat more progressive than Barack Obama on economic issues, and I also was very worried at the time about his belief that he could magically solve the problems, the gridlock in Washington, as though somehow it was the Clintons' fault that they faced the backlash they faced. And I thought that was a reflection of his having not been in Washington very long and that he was going to be surprised and set back if he became president by the kind of backlash that he got. And I happened to be right about that. Mm. So I spend a lot of time in the book, and I think Kathleen will vouch for me on this.
Yes, but, you do.
Talking about how we really need to have a more inclusive language around race, and I'm very much aware that at times I'm guilty of what I accuse others of. It's just that it's so hard right now because I do feel like Republicans are resorting to this old playbook with coded words and not so coded words.
You talk about that, and you just mentioned it briefly, but that 2008 election, which I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about before we go back to phone calls, being the most painful political experience for you. That was a hard one, that election.
You know, it was, because I've worked on and cared about these issues all my life. I spent, you know, I took a side path in the 80s and 90s, and I spent about a dozen years working on issues of urban poverty and education, mostly with, you know, not white-led groups. I would sometimes be the only white person in a room, and so I guess I took for granted that people knew that my heart was in the right place on racial issues, so that when I decided that I supported Hillary Clinton, first, I supported John Edwards, as did a lot of the multiracial group of people that I knew working
on
property.
What a disaster that was.
I know. So everyone can turn off the radio now because they now know my bad judgment. Don't listen to her about politics. I apologize. But he was the only person talking about the two Americas and poverty, and he was talking about white poverty as well. So at any rate, a digression. But I felt that when I looked at these two candidates, and when I saw that Hillary, in my opinion, had the stronger progressive domestic platform, she came out for a mortgage foreclosure moratorium, and Obama did not, for example. Her health care policy was more inclusive, including the dreaded individual mandate, which Obama opposed. There were several smallish issues like that, but I also thought that she had the more sympathetic appeal, that Obama's appeal could seem very ethereal, the hope, the talk and hope of hope and change. You know, I write in the book about how he could sound like the candidate of those New England do-gooders who always cared about African Americans but didn't ever care about the white poor and particularly Irish Catholics. There were old echoes of that of that tension in the race. And when I tried to talk about that, I found that I had a version of history that other people didn't seem to know. I became a fervent Obama supporter, and I am to this day, with lots of caveats and criticisms, but you know, given everything he's been up against, I think he's done a good job. But I really was very surprised and quite deeply hurt to be frequently called a racist for either defending or supporting Hillary Clinton. I thought that was really unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. Lori in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, thank you so much, ma'am. You have broached so many subjects. You said one statement about 3 minutes ago about how some of the leftist white people are worse than the rightists. And I have to say, I totally agree. I mean, it's so much I want to say, I can't hardly get any of it out. I want you to make sure you give your full name so I can go and purchase your book. I am not going to get it from the library. But my friends and I talk about this a lot. You can be a person of color. I live in Wisconsin. It's bad here being a person of color. It's really bad. You'll have the younger youth who deny it. Me in my age bracket, I'm 50 plus. It's bad. You walk into an elevator. You walk even at your job. I've had a person stand in front of me and spit in front of me as I'm trying to attempt to take care of them or work in service.
Really?
I'm sorry.
It's not the first time. It's the second time. That's the second time in my whole career. I've been working since I was 13. There's all kinds of things and isms. And you pray and you forgive and you pray and you pray and you continue to pray that maybe their eyes open. I asked that question of my grandmother when I was 6 years old. And she said, baby, they just don't get it. That's what's the matter with white people. They just don't get it. So I'm praying one day that they do, that they realize that they're black too, but they just don't know it. And I have approached that subject to them also before, that you're black and you just don't know you're black. Somewhere you're black.
We all originated in Africa. So
thank you so much for just saying it. And keep talking.
I will. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lori, for the call. Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Again, like the previous caller, there's so much to say. You mentioned the abolitionists as being Republicans, and generally they were. It was a Protestant movement, and there was anti-Catholicism in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. Many Democrats associated with the Democratic Party, but what was the Democratic Party? Their campaign song, the national campaign song in 1868 of the Democratic Party was the white man's banner. The first lines, we raise the white man's banner. It was the white man's party. That's what the Democratic Party was. It doesn't mean that Irish did. Some of the anti-black rioting in New York during the Civil War, the anti-draft rioting, some of it was Irish against the blacks. By 1900, though, even in Boston, the other side, you had signs, no Irish need apply. You had anti-Irish feelings even in 1900 in Boston. The trouble is that with affirmative action, no Irish need apply today for many jobs because of preferences given to minorities and women.
All right, we need to hold you there, Hugh. We can't take on the whole history of this, but pick whatever part you'd like, Joan.
Well, I write about the New York City draft riots, and, you know, they were a tragedy in Irish-American history, but they were also, they were a class riot, too, because the Irish were drafted and to fight the Civil War. They'd just come over, and that you could pay $300 to get out of the draft, and they didn't have it. So there was a very specific way that the Irish were pitted against black people in that instance, and the violence was ugly. The thing that I don't, that I think people, Irish Catholics don't entirely get, is the extent to which we were on the bottom at times, and we reacted with violence. I mean, the draft riots were the worst domestic insurrection in history before the Watts riots in 1965. So that's a black-Irish something we have in common that people don't talk about. In terms of the current day, I just don't believe, I know that affirmative action is not as prevalent as the caller says. I know it's a divisive issue. What happened in Boston in the 70s is, you know, busing often pitted the lowest income whites against poor black people. It rarely, the solutions that we imposed in the 60s and 70s rarely cost rich white people anything. They were always infringing on a little bit of territory that the white working class had carved out for itself. And so a lot of what we consider racism, I think, was a reaction to just barely having gotten enough and having some of it taken away. It was also racism, but I think it was somewhat more complicated than that.
And it opened affirmative action, another part of the 60s and 70s, the aftermath of that tumultuous decade. It opened up scores of possibilities for tens of thousands of people, for women and minorities. It really changed things in this country.
It did change things in this country, and, you know, and in some areas we need more change. I mean, that's the thing that I found frustrating in the book is that even with busing, I could never go back and say, well, busing was divisive and so we shouldn't have done it. I mean, I have African American friends who were bused, and that bus was their road out of poverty or the lower working class into the middle or upper middle class. We had such a history of segregation and racism that some of the solutions that we wound up using had to be divisive, had to be explosive. There really was no completely peaceful, easy, nobody's pie gets cut into solution for the horrible problem of slavery and then, you know, enforced segregation and discrimination. Believe me, I've spent time thinking about it, you know.
Oh, I know you have. I more than most people, you have. Joan Walsh is our guest this hour. The book is What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. Our number is 800-486-8655. Leave thoughts on Facebook, too, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show, or send an email, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls for Joan, Joe in Milwaukee. Hi, Joe.
Hi. your guest certainly brought up some important issues. I guess the main point that I see is that every society needs an out-group. And as she probably knows, when the Irish first came over here in the 1840s, they're actually below blacks and native people. And anyone coming into society, the major issue, I guess, or the major advantage they had was that they could speak English. But today, I think as never before, the out-groups certainly are blacks. Native people are pretty well invisible in this country. But as far as out-groups are concerned, one of the things that I think, as far as Obama's concerned, if the economy wasn't as bad as it was, he would never have had a chance, I think, of being elected in 2008. I think he squeaked by. And if he doesn't get elected re-elected this time, certainly race is going to play a major factor. No one's going to talk about it. That's the other thing. I listened to Travis Smiley yesterday, and he was dealing with the problems in New Orleans. The issue of race, they talked about people who were obviously prejudiced against, but they would not use the word race. And the last thing I wanted to mention is when we use the word to deal with blacks in their past, we use the word slave. Why can't we say enslaved? In other words, when you constantly label a group of people slaves, as far as their past, their history, it seems as though they were cooperative. Where if, and I hear more historians doing it today, using the word enslaved, so that it's something that was done to them, not something that they cooperated in. And finally, I'd say that, as we all know, Milwaukee is one of the most hyper-segregated cities in the United States. So, but most Milwaukeeans, particularly white Milwaukeeans, would shake their heads in disbelief at that.
Joan?
Yes, I like the point about enslaved. Slaves makes it sound as though it's somehow essential to their condition, and rather than something that was done to them. And yes, I know, as Kathleen said, I lived in Shorewood and went to Madison, and I know that as much as I love Milwaukee and there are so many great things about it, it is the most hyper-segregated city, and that hasn't changed. You know, it was a city of great heart that opened its heart to Henry Aaron, when lots of cities, including San Francisco, was such a hard place for Willie Mays to break into. So there are these great things like that in its history, and yet somehow, you know, that segregation hasn't changed. It's very tough to be African American and to be poor and African American in Milwaukee.
Look, you even got a chance to weave in baseball.
I did. How'd you like that?
I like that. The other thing, we were talking a little bit about this with, we talk about it all the time, actually. The fact that nobody seems to be addressing a lot of the concerns of minorities, Joan, which I find really appalling, that you look at breakfast programs and people standing out in line, and the lines, as far as I can tell, are getting longer and longer for free breakfast programs. You look at the African-American unemployment rate, which the Republicans are touting this week, and yet nobody seems to be paying very much attention to it. All of these issues, I'm wondering if, because the president is half white and half African American, it's difficult for him to address, because of race, these very issues, and why it is nobody's taking on the issues of poverty in this country. It's, you know, forget it. Nobody says anything.
I've been stunned by this my whole life. I mean, since the war on poverty, I think the backlash against the war on poverty was so profound. And Reagan, you know, Reagan won with that statement. We fought a war on poverty, and poverty won. Suddenly, it was radioactive politically, but it was also radioactive in the sense that, well, everything we do makes it worse, so why even bother? Reagan really gave white people permission not to care, because we cared once and we made it worse. It wasn't true, but I think that line of thinking carried the day. And then the Democrats, I think, went out of their way, including Bill Clinton, who I admire a great deal, to make clear that they weren't the party of poor people, that they were the party of the middle class. And, you know, Barack Obama and Joe Biden talk about middle class, middle class, middle class. But, you know, the hard thing is, though, that the middle class is suffering. So that, you know, I think as suffering has widened, that it becomes harder to talk about the poor, because so many more people are really having a hard time. You would just wonder if that would give people more compassion for those who've been struggling, but I'm not sure, who've been struggling the longest, but I'm not sure, sadly, that it works that way.
Let's go. Thanks, Joe, for the call. Wayne in Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning.
Hi, Wayne.
Yeah, I enjoy your guest. I think she's trying to be objective. I'm a Catholic conservative. My question to you would be this. I understand you appear on MSNBC, and that's okay. Yeah. I find it hard to listen to it in the evening because Ed Schultz has made some comments that I'd like you to comment on. He referred to Laura Ingraham, a conservative woman, as that stupid talk show host, I can't use the four-letter word. He also said, and I quote, I want to rip Dick Cheney's heart out, kick it around like a football, and stuff it back in his chest, close quote. Now, this comes from very liberal Democrats that you may be familiar with. What are your thoughts on comments such as that? Thank you very much.
I really am only responsible for my own comments, and I wouldn't say anything like that. So I know that Ed Schultz apologized profoundly to Laura Ingraham, and I believe he served a short suspension. So, but, you know, I'm not responsible for the words of others. I wrote 80,000 words in this book, so, and I've said many words on television. I have enough trouble keeping up with what I've said, so I'm just going to leave it there.
You must feel good, though. It must feel a wonderfully satisfying feeling to have looked at, as you did, at so much of the history of this, in terms of your own family, in terms of your Irish background, in terms of the civil rights movement, in terms of labor protests in New York. There is a whole body of information that unfortunately doesn't make its way to television very often, and I'm glad you did the book. It's a big contribution. It must make you feel good, doesn't it?
Thank you. It does make me feel good. It was a real privilege to get to spend so much time thinking about these issues. Anne Lamott once said that, you know, writers should write the book that you need to read, and this was the book that I needed to read.
Oh, I like that.
And it turned out that some other people apparently feel they need to read it too, which I really appreciate.
Thanks, Joan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen. I'll come back.
Joan Walsh, please come back. The book is What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. We are going to be off on Monday for Labor Day, back with you Tuesday at 9 a.m., a special edition of All Things Political from the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. We will have a reporter from North Carolina Public Radio, and MSNBC host Melissa Harris-Perry will be joining us as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers.